Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm your host, Dori Smith. The fragile Darfur peace agreement signed in May of 2006 has fallen apart, and now the entire region could be even more unstable unless the significant figures in the conflict and an international team of negotiators can reach an agreement. Connecticut journalist and author David Morse shares portions of his interviews in search of a solution to the genocide in Darfur. Morse interviewed Harvard scholars studying Darfur for a book he's working on about Darfur and Sudan. He was in Sudan last December interviewing officials with the Sudan People's Liberation Movement. His website is david-morse.com.
I interviewed Harvard's Alex Duval November 21st at his home in the Boston area. Duval is a professor at Harvard, now working on AIDS in Africa, but a well-known expert on Darfur, and was himself a key member of the negotiating team that worked out the May agreement. And the main problem that he faced in this role was the lack of time that really that was being committed to the process. The earlier agreement between the North and the South, which ended 21 years of civil war, had taken 3 or 4 years to put in place. And it, as with most comprehensive peace agreements, it involved a ceasefire and then guarantees of security so that the government troops would withdraw to garrisons. There would be no aggressive flights, and the rebels would cease their activity and then eventually disarm. And then there would be an era of power sharing and wealth sharing accompanied by the reintegration of the hostile parties so that you get the Janjaweed to lay down their arms and you also reintegrate them into society, and the same with the rebels. The situation in Darfur has deteriorated since the peace treaty that was signed in May of this year was signed and led, if anything, to more violence, bombing by the government of non-Arab villages, and rebels attacking refugee camps as well. It's gotten grimmer, and at this point, with rations cut by 50%, the danger now is of genocide by attrition, by starvation and opportunistic diseases. And people, those of us who consider ourselves activists in the effort to save Darfur, should we be calling for a fairly massive deployment of peacekeepers by the United Nations or under the aegis of the African Union? It's not quite as simple as it appears. We really do need Khartoum to agree to the introduction of additional peacekeeping troops. I know this sounds incredibly paradoxical, to ask permission of the perpetrators of genocide to protect those whom they're in the process of killing. But if you don't get Khartoum to acquiesce, and remember Omar al-Bashir, the president of Sudan, his back is against the wall politically. If you don't get Khartoum's acquiescence, you may end up with an even uglier war. The peace treaty that was signed between the North and the South in January of 2005 was the product of several years of negotiation. The peace treaty that was signed most recently was really mainly the product of 3 months. So I talked with Alex Duval, who is author of Darfur, A Short History of a Long War. He co-writes that with Julie Flint and brings to that perspective a feet-on-the-ground experience as a journalist and as an anthropologist of the situation in Darfur and the dynamics that make it such an intractable problem. He tried very hard to convince the State Department and the African Union that this was going to take a long time, that just because it's a small war and relatively short by the standards of the region, basically 3.5 years, it wasn't necessarily going to be a quick fix. So he advised the African Union and the State Department to take its time, to let the process take how long it needed, and was told, unfortunately, that they wouldn't have the 6 to 9 months that he thought was needed, but rather it would have to be done in 2 or 3 months. There was pressure from Washington and some pressure from the UK as well. One problem is that the two principals, the two main leaders of the rebel movements, Amini Maneli, who is a Zagawa, and Abdel Wahid, who is a Fur, the dominant tribe, don't get along terribly well. Abdelwahid balked, did not sign. So the only signer was Mini Minnelli, who really controls a minority. So it was doomed for failure for that reason. So you had to go through a period of diplomacy, and Alex Duval, in fact, stayed. He was the last one to leave in an effort to get Abdelwahid to sign on. So there are problems with personality, there are tribal rivalries, and there is the omnipresent failure of the government in Khartoum to move very far. It moved surprisingly far, according to Alex Duval. I don't think anyone had worked harder than Alex Duval to make this thing work against almost impossible odds. I asked him what the chances were now that the process is broken down. What are the chances of it being restarted? What are the prospects for peace?
It's very uncertain now. I think the meeting that was in Addis Ababa last week with Kofi Annan was a step in the right direction. What was reported in the media was that they had watered down the UN troops issue, and it's true they have. But that's not the central issue. The central issue is not peacekeepers. The central issue is the political solution. And what Kofi Annan had managed to do was to get all the key international players united for the first time since May, for the first time for more than 6 months, behind a political strategy. And the political strategy, ceasefire and new round of negotiations to resolve the outstanding differences. Now, then this three-step approach towards improving the peacekeeping. Number one, which is what's called light support from the UN to the AU, which is what's already happening. Two is heavy support, a lot of UN infrastructure going in to support the AU on the ground. And the third is a joint operation, which the Sudan government has not agreed to. Now, there are two points to make. One is, I think, that the political strategy is, I think, the correct one. It's not guaranteed of success, and the main reason for that is that it doesn't fully take into account Chad and the war in Chad, which has its own dynamic, quite separate from Darfur. Even if Darfur is settled, Chad will still be at war. And the fact that the GEM and the National Redemption Front, partly for that reason, are not willing to join this political process. So this political process is incomplete. However, if it brings in the SLM and the G19, who are call themselves SLM, they call themselves SLM Unity, then it will have something. The other point to make is, to my mind, this actually is also an issue which I advised the AU and the UN and the State Department, as I said, don't make peacekeepers the key issue. This issue of UN troops was always a distraction for two reasons. Number one, there was never a prospect of sending a UN force in without Khartoum's consent. It just was never going to happen. It was not practical.
Can you say why?
Well, let me explain how the figures were arrived at. When we had the security talks in Abuja in March and April of this year, part of what we were doing was mapping all the forces. We got a huge map and overlays, transparent overlays, and we got the Sudan government to put all its garrisons and camps and so on one overlay, Mini Minawi on another, Abdelwahid on another, etc. And then, so each one could only see their own, and then we could, you know, put them all together. And based on that, on those overlays, which had got all the military positions marked out, there was an implementation team with the AU force commander and the UN working together, and someone from State Department as well. Two UN generals, and they worked on an implementation plan which involved on the map, demilitarizing certain areas, certain roads, all the withdrawal, all the different activities that would be required in order to make ceasefire and security arrangements to work. And on the basis of that, then the AU force commander and the two UN generals estimated what it would take to implement the different stages of the ceasefire. And they said the full strength to properly implement this would take about 20,000 troops. The initial stage would take about 11, then it would be something like 14 or 15, then it would be 20,000, which would be 17,000 troops, 3,000 civilian police. The civilian police mainly for the IDP camps, because there's a provision there for the Sudanese police to withdraw from the camps and the IDPs to have their own police as a community police, but that has to be trained and supervised by an international civilian police. So just in order to police this quite complex ceasefire, you need 20,000 troops. If you want to disarm the Janjaweed, you need a lot more. Now, Janjaweed is something like 20 to 30,000. To disarm them by force, you will need a huge force, maybe 60,000. The government can do that, and the government is obliged to do that under the DPA. If the UN is to do it, the UN will need an enormous force. Now, if the UN is to then go in, not only to implement this, but to go in without the consent of the Sudanese armed forces, and there are about 60,000 of the Sudanese armed forces in Darfur, if you include allied militia, probably about 40,000 regular army, 25,000 militia.
Those numbers don't look good.
Yeah. It's some of them wouldn't want to fight, but you only need a few of them to fight, and you have a very, very serious problem. You can't do it.
With civilians caught in the middle.
Yeah, exactly. And what we know from, say, Somalia, where the UN got into a fight with Hadid in Mogadishu, the moment you get into that situation, you run the risk of seriously antagonizing the local population. And you can't do anything else. You can't, other than fight. When you are fighting a war, you cannot protect civilians and have a humanitarian operation and fight a war at the same time. You can't do it. So to me, this was always a non-starter.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It was never a realistic prospect to put it on the table. The other point is that if you look at the UN, the history of the UN, when has the UN ever really effectively protected civilians? Didn't do it in Sarajevo or in Srebrenica. Didn't do it in Rwanda. Didn't do it in Somalia. The UN peacekeepers can only keep a peace if there is a peace. And if you recognize that, and you recognize that what you need to do is make something happen that is under the command and control of the local people, rather than trying to impose something, however welcome in principle, you then have a very different concept of operations. And what I was arguing for was, let's get away from the question of what is the mandate, what is the colour of the helmets, who is to do it. Let's actually ask, what is it that needs to be done? And if you look at the demilitarisation and stabilisation of Darfur, anyone who seriously looks at it realises this is a 6 to 10 year job. Whatever forces are there will need to be there for 6 to 10 years in order to stabilise Darfur. And in order to get that done, you need the support of the key players, the key tribal leaders, the key communities. You'll need some green light from the government, but you don't need the agreement of the government every step. If you have the agreement of the communities, that's what counts. Then, if you're considering something like the challenge of disarming the Janjaweed, what you want to do is you want to get the Janjaweed to a position where either they will voluntarily disarm, or you can get all the other forces in the region to side with you against them. Because you don't want to fight them, you want them to do what you want, which is to lay down their weapons. And if they are going to resist, you want everyone else in Darfur to be on your side against them.
Mm-hmm.
And this is actually not difficult to do. This is the standard approach to peace building. And it was done, for example, in South Kordofan next door in the Nuba Mountains, where you had a very complex situation, very complex ceasefire with militia, etc. That was an agreement was signed there in January 2002. No one predicted it would hold, but it did, and it held with just 24 unarmed ceasefire monitors. And the reason why it held in Nuba Mountains was that the ceasefire monitors worked with the local community leaders and used them as their eyes and ears and so on in order to make sure that both sides stuck to it.
So that, do you think that's a realistic model for Darfur?
I think it's the only model. I would say I don't think you could do it with 24 unarmed ceasefire monitors. Mm-hmm. I don't think you could do it with 200 or 2,000 unarmed ceasefire monitors. But the approach has to be the same.
Mm-hmm.
The approach has to be one which is 9 parts community relations and politics to 1 part force.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you're going to do it by force, you're going to need a force of 200,000 troops or something like that. And you're going to need to fight, and that's simply not going to happen. It's probably not going to work if you try it. So what you need to do is use the mechanisms that have been tried and have been shown to work in these situations. And while Darfur is pretty horrible. It's not unlike other situations that we've had in the past, in parts of Somalia, parts of Ethiopia, in other parts of Sudan, where you have a complex militarized society with people fighting each other, massacres of civilians. But you also have authority structures that are ready to get on side in stabilizing the situation.
Assuming the best possible scenario and that something like this has worked out, what do you do with the Janjaweed? Once they've laid down their weapons, what becomes of them? How do you incorporate them into civilian society?
The Janjaweed are a number of different groups.
You were speaking of where they come from, and I think that's incidentally another thing where your book has been very valuable, the origin of the Janjaweed.
I mean, what we're seeing now is some of them are going back to Chad, which is not a solution. Mm-hmm. It doesn't help.
No. It sounds prescription for disaster, isn't it?
They have to have a... The groups that they come from have to have a place. There has to be some accommodation for them, because historically they have been...
They have no place at the table, do they?
Yeah, exactly. This is one of them.
They have no representation in government?
Not directly. I mean, some of the political leaders of the groups from whom the Janjaweed are formed are there in government, but the government doesn't trust them either. There's the government is quite fearful of them. Mm-hmm. And one can quite easily imagine a situation in which there is some sort of settlement, but a lot of the Janjaweed feel that they have been betrayed, let down, and they have no stake in this. And you don't want that situation, then they can create more havoc.
And there's no, if I understand it, no corridors contrived by which they can move their livestock.
There can be. I mean, there... there were plans, in fact there were maps that were drawn up for them to have their corridors, but the government typically tried to manipulate that. I mean, if the government just let things be, if they just allowed these people to work things out themselves, they would often solve their own problems, but the government always wants to manipulate something to its own.
I've often thought that Khartoum behaves more like a ancient city-state, exploiting its hinterlands than a modern capital.
I think that's very true. I think it has a lot of continuities from when it was essentially a trading emporium in the 19th century. And the concept of citizenship really isn't there. Mm-hmm. And you have the city, and you have various degrees of periphery, of the immediate periphery, which is actually relatively well-treated. The immediate, 100 kilometres outside Khartoum is actually relatively prosperous. Then you have the outer periphery, places like the south and Darfur, which are ruthlessly exploited. Mm-hmm. And then the periphery actually extends over the borders, this into Chad and Central African Republic. It's not a concept of a territorially bounded state. It's a degrees of closeness and exploitation.
Earlier, I'm going to extend something you said a little bit. Earlier you said with the peace that one needs to sort of look at what has to be done rather than get obsessed over the color of the helmets and so forth and approach it from that sort of functional point of view. It seems to me functionally, and I don't know whether this is even a fair question, but functionally it's clear that for regional peace to obtain, somebody has got to sit down with these people regionally and arrive at some kind of social equity, some basic delivering of services and that sort of thing. If not Khartoum, who? And we're getting run up against the inviolate state, but we've got a semi-failed state, it seems, almost, or at least a state that's dysfunctional.
It's a state that's deeply dysfunctional, but it still manages to survive and will continue to survive. And what's interesting about Khartoum is that it has this combination of being economically completely dominant, not only of the Sudanese territory, but even beyond it in economic terms, with really quite a very, very capable and quite cohesive capitalist class there. But within it, politically, it is unstable. They don't agree politically among themselves. There's a level of instability and turbulence within that state, which is one of the reasons why it is so continually at war. It's not because they are incredibly clever and Machiavellian at deluding people. It's that they are always shifting their own internal coalitions, which means that any deal you do with Khartoum is only as good for as long as that particular coalition holds.
Mm-hmm.
And then if it shifts, then the deal changes. And that's why it is so perfidious. It's not because they're liars.
Mm.
The reason why all governments in Sudan behave in the same way
mm-hmm.
is because of this structural feature that they've never managed to consolidate control over the state in the same way. They're always shifting with different groups emerging.
What would it take, pie in the sky, what would it take to get them to behave in a more coherent way? Not that we can affect this, but...
I think the key is to look long-term. If you look at the question of how was peace achieved in the South, the key to it was a mixture of the right strategy and tactics. Strategically, the essence of it was an assurance that came from the United States, from Senator Danforth, who, to my mind, is a much underestimated figure. I thought he was remarkably astute. And he assured both President Bashir and John Garang, he said, the United States wants a united Sudan that functions. That's it. That is the US interest. And if you can deliver that, we will support you. And when you have a long-term vision, that quite a simple vision that the parties can buy into, then you have something to work with. And tactically, it worked because there was a system of tests, which were, if you pass this test, if you stop bombing, if you have an investigation mm-hmm. into slavery, if you have a ceasefire in the Nuba Mountains, then something will follow from that. And it worked tactically as well because it wasn't stuck with artificial deadlines. It allowed enough time to work through mm-hmm. these issues at mm-hmm. the negotiating table. Now, those lessons seem to get jettisoned when we got onto Darfur,
mm-hmm.
where there was no certitude coming out of Washington as to what the outcome was going to be. There was no clear goalpost. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, the Sudan government was deeply hypocritical when it said, look, the US has changed its policy. Well, of course the US changed its policy because the Sudan government wasn't going out and murdering tens of thousands of people in Darfur before that. So, of course, but the reality of politics is you do need to accommodate what is the other side's legitimate interest.
Mm-hmm.
And no matter how murderous a government, a state does have a legitimate concern. And the worst possible outcome for Sudan would be a contested partition if the South were to withdraw in a contested way. Now, we know what happened in India in 1947, in Yugoslavia. When you get a contested partition, everything else, forget it. And that is what we're looking at if we don't have a core common consensus mm-hmm. about what where Sudan is going to be some way down the road.
And if I might add, that has to include China.
Yeah, I'm afraid so, yeah. It has to be in there.
But what you've described, the ideal that the U.S. government, through Danforth, was expressing, that we want a functional and coherent Sudan, I could imagine that as being a realistic goal for the Chinese. So
yeah.
What's keeping us from getting on the same page with the Chinese? Why?
Well, it's interesting in this meeting that Kofi Annan had in Addis Ababa last week with the Security Council ambassadors, mm-hmm. the most helpful one was the Chinese. And one of the reasons was that Kofi Annan came out and said, this is what we want. And suddenly, then you turn the Chinese from an adversary into an ally. And the Chinese actually now engaged in pushing Sudan government to accept UN troops.
Mm-hmm.
Precisely because it says, well, we're comfortable with the overall strategy and the direction of this. And the Sudan government, or rather the Congress Party, about 6 months ago, held its internal review of its relations with the US. And it came to the conclusion that whatever we give to the US, it will demand something more. That there's nothing we can do to satisfy the US. And I think that arises because there is no clear vision for Sudan that is arising from Washington. What is happening is a whole lot of tactical maneuvers and threats. We want you to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't, we will do that.
Mm-hmm.
And the this that Washington wants Khartoum to do is always something very short-term, like accept UN troops. And they're thinking, what is this? Mm-hmm. Why do they want us to accept UN troops? And they can't figure it out. And so they get deeply suspicious, they dig their heels in, and we get into this standoff. Mm-hmm. And you know, the fact is that it's a grotesque regime, but it's not an irrational regime. You can understand why it behaves the way it does, mm-hmm. and that is a lot to do with its own internal instability and its own apprehensions. And the only way to stop this is by accommodating that.
And speaking of those internal divisions, what do you think is the likelihood that Darfur is an effort at regime change in Khartoum?
I think the two groups that are going for regime change at the moment, there's the National Redemption Front, mm-hmm. Which has links to Chad, also to the Turabi group in Khartoum, and then some of the groups in Washington, who basically see the only way of stopping this is a policy of regime change. I don't think it's workable. I don't like this government, but I think the idea of regime change by force is a disaster. Things are moving very fast at the moment. We could quite easily see regime change in Chad or Central African Republic by then. I think the internal crises in both those countries are accelerating. If this current strategy, this current attempt to get the politics back on track, doesn't succeed in the next 4 weeks, then the US government could, I think mistakenly, could escalate its rhetoric, because I don't think there's much it can do. And I think it would, if it did that, they're talking about a plan B without saying what it is. The implication being that this might be some kind of military action. To me, that's just going to make things worse. I don't see, it going anywhere.
Things could all fall apart in Chad. Meanwhile, we've also got dynamics that seem to be just shifting across the border, where Janjaweed in the north are attacking Chadians in the south. Mm. You're suggesting that that's part of the instability.
I think there's a temptation to see the Chadian crisis just as a spillover from Darfur, and I think that's a mistake. You have to recognize that it has its internal origins in Chad, which are very significant.
And is Gaddafi still playing an active role in all of this behind the scenes, or?
He's in there. I mean, I think he just wants to be seen to be playing a role, and he wants to keep out international troops. When people in Sudan talk about international troops, they talk about Quwat Dawliya, international forces, and it's the same term in Arabic that's used for the coalition troops in Iraq and Afghanistan. It is the same mm-hmm. thing. It is regime change.
And the incipient potential for jihad.
I think they would then, they'd declare a jihad. I think their credentials for doing so are very, very flimsy. But I think there'd be enough people prepared to take mm-hmm. it seriously. That it's
just because of our low level of credibility.
Yep, exactly.
And that was David Morse of Connecticut interviewing Harvard's Alex Duvall. David Morse is author of the September 2005 report, Facing Evil, Genocide in Darfur, published in Friends Journal, and Blood, Ink, and Oil, The Case of Darfur, published in Common Dreams in July of 2005. An independent journalist, David Morse is also the author of a novel, The Iron Bridge. You can contact him through his website at david-morse.com. David Morse will be using this and other interviews for his upcoming book on Darfur and Sudan. Alex Duvall was a member of the negotiating team for the May peace agreement with Darfur. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. Talk Nation Radio is produced in the studios of WHUS, Radio for the People at UConn, the University of Connecticut. WHUS.org to listen live, Wednesdays at 5 p.m. TalkNation.org and TalkNationRadio.org for transcripts and discussions.